Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams. Hello and welcome to Game of Nodes, a bi-weekly and occasionally slightly more than bi-weekly podcast from independent validator nodes. This week we have Brendan from Whisper Nodes with us, old friend of the treehouse, of the bunker, of whatever it is, whichever nefarious location that we are doing all of our plotting at any given time. And recently joined Flipside, right? That's the news in the Brendan bunker.
Yes, sir. Yeah, happy to be over there, kind of getting away from the validator world and into the data world.
Sounds a little bit like out of the frying pan into the fire. I'm guessing in your day-to-day right now, just like everybody in tech, you're hearing the words AI about 1,000 times a day, right?
Jesus Christ, yeah. Yeah, and I'm using the shit too, or I'm trying to anyway.
Yeah, what kind of stuff for?
Just like automating all day-to-day actions that I can. So with Flipside, I'm doing sales and account management. So, you know, I have a CRM and I kind of have a lot of follow-ups to do, conversations to track. So I built an MCP server and then hooked that into Claude. So basically I can do everything with work by clicking a button, speaking to Claude, and then Claude will go use the MCP server to make a bunch of API calls. So it's pretty cool.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess that's what happens when you hire somebody that used to be like running essentially mission critical stuff for years in a stressful situation to do something that is not strictly technical. It's like, well, this is like a lot less stressful than everything else I've been doing. I guess I'll just come out with a great way of automating this that takes some of the pain away from my bollocks, huh?
Yeah, I feel like we like to over-engineer everything, hence whatever the hell Schulze has going on in his background that he was talking about pre-show.
My mini data center, yes.
Yeah.
So if you've got a Lavender 5 testnet participation coming up, it's going to be, the action's going to be happening from behind Schulze, right?
Probably.
Yeah. You know, I'm not good at business like the rest of you, but I remember GCSE business studies. You get those fixed costs and it's all upside, baby, right? That's how business works.
That's what I've heard. Yes.
How much has your mini data center set you back so far?
Well, it depends on what all you build in there, right? So like just in hardware, about $12,000.
Cool.
Yeah. And most of that is in hard drives. So
the second you say hard drives, you know that Null's going to appear on the call, right?
That's right. Well, like this one is $700, $800. And there's basically this machine right here is full of them. That's for the archive nodes. So quite a bit. So just for hardware, 12,000. Cool. Servers themselves, the pricing for the servers themselves are fairly cheap, but RAM and hard drives is just ridiculously expensive.
And then
on top of that, I have new networking gear because previously I couldn't like create VLANs in my network. Now I can. So now if someone decides to jump into the servers, then they can't access everything else on the network. And then I'm working on building out basically a whole house universal power supply so that if power goes out, the nodes would still be running. So I should have, in theory, upwards of a week of runtime if all power goes out. And then there's like redundant network providers, and it's been a whole project and a lot of fun.
This is definitely the sort of project that somebody does when they're finally getting some sleep. So I can only assume that is what has happened. And so it's just unleashed this tidal wave of what seems to me to be an exhausting amount of energy and planning for what is, to be fair, a cool project. But
it's been fun. A lot of it is like with the devaluation of the dollar, we are paying about $3,000 more per month than we were like 6 months ago. with no change in servers, right? So like $12,000 sounds like a lot until suddenly that's actually 4 months of server costs. And so basically as I'm shifting things over from servers onto these and other servers, it's going to eat up all that cost really quickly.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense. When I used to work for like agency type setups, we quite often had like, you know, customer type, you know, like a staging server for a customer or like pre-production or whatever would be like, it would be like, hey, what's this thing under the desk that's beeping? It's like, oh, that's like Jeff's old server from home. We just stuck 8 hard drives on it and juiced the RAM. And that's just, that's staging. When you log into staging, it's the one on the desk. Don't fucking unplug it. So like, I feel like this is a well-trodden, it's a well-trodden path. I mean, we'd actually looked into it in our shared office, but, unfortunately, in terms of our lease, are that we can't just like rack up stuff and run a data center from our shared office because, so there is a thing in the lease basically saying that we can't run a data center from there, but it is quite specifically a data center. So I wonder if, it's like, there's like a, I think it's because the whole building's networking is like obviously done by, it's managed by the people who own the building. And then you have like the networking and everything for your unit and blah, 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 blah. I think it must be something to do with like the network switch or damage their hardware or their use somewhere. Like there must be some reason that they're a bit iffy. I mean, it might just straight up be that they don't want to fire and they.
Well, and power's really expensive, right? I mean, so yeah, like what do I pay for that?
No, but we pay for it as part of our RAM racks. Oh. We have a power agreement. Oh, actually, I say that very confidently. Maybe there is something in that. Maybe that is it. Are you burning a lot of power then?
Not actually all that much. These servers are running about like 30 to 40 watts each, but that still means there's a constant 250 watt draw. So 6 kilowatt hours a day. So $1 a day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I wish we could run more stuff on. Do you remember when people were like home hacking those Raspberry Pi blades where you did like a cluster of Raspberry Pis in a big stack? That was the coolest shit, man.
That is actually, this rack is actually intended exactly for that. This is by DeskPi, the DeskPi team. So it's intended for creating racks of Raspberry Pis. And I actually have a bunch of modules that come with it that I was just like, meh, throw that in the corner.
Did you build any weird stuff with it? Like my buddy actually just started playing with those Raspberry Pis and he took an old cell phone and he made it into like a nanny cam. So like, I wonder what's going on Schultz's shelf over there. He's definitely got some spyware or something.
Well, no, mine's pretty run of the mill. It's literally just mini PCs.
Yeah.
They're effectively laptops without screens, really. They're even running laptop chips. So
sick,
which are surprisingly powerful these days. So like the Hetzner 7950Xs, right? These are basically as powerful as them in those little cubes. They're technically a little bit less powerful because they have fewer cores, but in terms of like the core themselves, they're absolutely insane. Like what you can stick on these little things is outrageous.
Wow.
Interesting. I can see this is how you get into it, right? You're just like, all the facts you're providing are interesting data points for servers that I do not need.
Well, I had looked into servers before and like talking to Artifact, he was like, yeah, well, you can, you know, get a server for $2,000 and then you can get your disk and the RAM for it. And I was always like, that seems pretty ridiculous. Each one of those is $300 with the CPU. So you just supply the RAM and the disk. So each one ends up being, you know, $600 or $700 instead. That's a much better cost proposition.
I mean, I've got 3 years of 3U of rack space, like literally here in my desk, because I took out the old Roland JV synth. I've been getting rid of some musical kit that I haven't been using. We still got all the modular shit over here. Don't worry, longtime fans of the podcast. We still got lots of wires and synthesizers and stuff, but the one of the Roland JV synths has gone. I've got 3U of rack space and an isolated power strip. So maybe I should set my house on fire by putting some racks in here. Huh? That would be cool. maybe foolish. I don't know. Suddenly my interest in this crazy scheme has been reinvigorated. What's the Homer Simpson line? I find your ideas intriguing and I would like to subscribe to your newsletter. I think that's how he ends up in the cult, isn't it? That's the line.
That sounds right.
I feel this is like something usurper would know. So yeah, okay, cool. So big battery, big solar array. Does the viability of it? You're in the States, but I think you're in a sunnier. It's sunnier where you are than England.
No. It's actually about the same as where you are. Oregon. Yeah.
Oh man,
it's mostly cloudy.
He gave away his location now. Now we know where all his servers are.
They're somewhere in the very small state of Oregon.
Yep.
Somewhere in Oregon, near avocados, near coffee. It could be anywhere. Right.
Absolutely anywhere. Yeah, no, it's generally cloudy. It's like cloudy something like 210 days a year, I want to say.
Oh, shit. Okay, so it's like anti-Denver.
Yeah, so... Basically what that means is my solar panels, I had to go really overboard in order to actually be able to cover my energy usage.
We've got, I think, I want to say we've got like 10 or 12 on our roof. It's not like a I assume it's probably a smaller house than yours because, again, England. And we did not obviously cover our... but I think again part of that problem is also battery. Like we actually don't have a battery in the house because right. The way, at the risk of becoming Game of Nodes the energy subsidy and government policy podcast, the way it used to work for getting solar panels in this country was simply that to incentivize it, you sell your power back to the grid. So every house, probably the same as you guys, right? Every house has an inverter. Mine is not under my desk. I think it's in the toilet there. This is just under the toilet. Great positioning, but if you fit it where you can. But it does mean that there wasn't like at the time a big incentive to put in batteries. And then that came like the technology for batteries kind of came along like maybe 5 years after the original subsidy for solar panels. So a lot of people that got solar panels, then batteries became good, but it wasn't like necessarily joined up for everybody. Some people who got solar panels later got batteries and solar panels, especially with like electric vehicles. It makes a lot more sense, right?
So the way my setup works, the solar panels are not connected to the grid. They connect directly to the battery pack. And so the battery pack then basically pushes the power to the house, but it stops there. It can't push power back into the grid, which has ups and downs. The good thing is that in essence, the house chooses the battery first. So that's why if the grid goes out, it's literally 0 millisecond turnover time for like the house to have power because it's powering from the battery, but you can't get any pay back if you overproduce.
Okay.
The guys that set my solar up originally, they forgot to put the inverter or they forgot to put a switch. So when I got hooked up to the power company and they actually put the grid through my house, it blew all my solar and all my inverters.
No, that's insane.
Puerto Rico things. Schulte knows.
I don't want to talk about Puerto Rico, to be honest with you. I'm still like recovering. That was a tough like 6 months of my life.
We're roughing it out here, man.
I'm just still angry that so for Dr. Frey over here, there was a proposal after Hurricane Maria, I think, where they were going to, in effect, get rid of a central power plant in southern Puerto Rico and instead do microgrids, because Puerto Rico has sun basically all the time, right? Except for like at 3:10 p.m., which it pours down rain for a minute and a half, and then it goes back to sun. So they're going to set up like 30 microgrids in the island, all paid for the government. And it was like totally reasonably cost. And then there'd be solar panels, all over, whatever. So I don't remember what happened, but something with the U.S. government was like, absolutely not. We can't get rid of fossil fuels. You guys are so funny. And they vetoed it. And so now there's an even worse system now.
Yeah.
So they go back to the original power plant and they did something. And we were losing power weekly.
Oh, yeah. Every week. That's why I had to get the solar. Crazy. So no servers in my house.
I was going to say, oh, that was going to be my next question. Was it was the motivation for getting the solar, Brandon, the Whisper node testnet set up, or was it just like you were just tired of not having Wi-Fi because or sitting in a dark room?
Pretty much, yeah. It was like if I needed to work, I needed power.
So. Yeah, okay, that figures, right?
If I remember correctly, solar is relatively cheap in Puerto Rico, right? When I talked to my landlord there, she was like, oh yeah, I've got this big old array and it costs like $1,100. I was like, what? Yeah. Like 10% of what it was?
I think I paid like $20,000 for mine, but I'm like pretty much off grid, so it's not too bad. I think 26 panels. And
26 panels?
Big. Yeah. A lot. Yeah.
Man, wow. You need a big battery for that. So, goddamn, I'm just so sorry. That's back to like small European houses and small European perspective. Be like, that's a lot of fucking solar panels. There's like a house I cycle past on my way to work most days, where they've obviously decided that they just want done with paying for power. And they have literally like all the way down their roof and then kind of on the side of the house. And I'm kind of wondering whether it's actually illegal, because it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that somebody would say, yeah, you could just like string up solar panels on the side of your house, but on the side of the house, and then their entire front garden and then all down the side of the house visible from the road is just solar panels. And they've sort of been set up just, I think, so a person can like squeeze sideways past them to get to the rear of the house. But I'm like, I always like cycle past it. And I think like, if you need to like, I don't know, like take a sofa through your back door or carry a ladder around the back of your house, like how are you going to do it? How are you going to do it? Like there's no, I guess the answer is probably try and carry it through the house, but like.
Inconvenient.
I mean, I guess they obviously thought of that and they went, yeah, actually the number of times I had to carry a sofa through my house, probably one in 20 years and free, and you know, pay for this and get free power. So probably it's again, previous comment, don't understand business. There we go. So yeah, speaking of not understanding business, that wasn't really a good setup. But so Brendan, what made you decide to go and work with Flipside?
It was kind of the perfect marrying of all my Web3 experience. So I used to work for Secret Network doing growth stuff very closely with Tor Bear, head of marketing, and I ran the ambassador program over there, and kind of just through that whole experience saw how projects don't really operate like Web2 projects, where they are using data to inform their decisions. They're just kind of like throwing money like all over the place and hoping that they have ROI somewhere. So and then obviously got into running Whispernode after that, validators. And Flipside.
Wait, I thought, yeah. Whispernode came before then. I didn't realize Whispernode was after you started then.
Oh, yeah.
So, okay. This changes everything for me. So how did you start with Secret Network then? Like what was the catalyst there?
Man, I was an ambassador back when they were Enigma in 2017, like after the ICO craze back then.
Wow. Okay. So you are OG, or as OG as you can be in the Cosmos kind of space.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were one of the first kind of Cosmos app chains. I think they had smart contracts second only to Luna, if I recall.
Wow.
Yeah. That would make sense based on that. Yeah. I think that's about right. Something like that.
Yeah.
Because they were, both them and Luna were on, like a pre-version one stable version of Cosmosm, weren't they?
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it was. Yeah, and Schulte just learned the validator game. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, to be honest, when I first started running it. Figured it out over time. Obviously had Ghost join the team at some point in November 2021. And just kept learning more about the tech side of things. And Flipside was like this perfect marrying of data-driven growth, which I could understand the value proposition right away, having kind of worked in growth in Web3. And then they also have an infra arm where they run validators for the projects that they're doing growth with.
So you are not doing the validator operation side. You are just doing the data. Okay. Do you criticize the NodeOps guys? Are you like, you bunch of fools? I've been doing this for 2 years.
I know, right?
Seven.
No, they're pretty good over there. They're like really solid guys. But it is funny having kind of people that are way more technically knowledgeable than I am, having, you know, Web2 sysadmin experience, you know, spinning up all kinds of Docker containers and over engineering like everything. And then they're coming to me asking for like advice on running Cosmos nodes. And I'm, you know, just like, why?
You know, you hit start and make sure you have a seed and then you're good.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like when, I mean, all the shit that like I look at now and I look at, the company's past financials and I go, well, that was kind of thick. But when we first started running nodes, it was like straight off the bat. Like it was, I think the first nodes that I ran were when I had an enterprise contract that was winding down at the time. Right. So I was going from like day job where it was all like, to be fair, what I've been doing was actually architecting a system that was completely on demand. So it was probably the cutting edge platform wise of what that business had to, you know, in their entire tech stack. But it was like all AWS, all serverless, on demand databases, on demand nightly snapshots, all of it just completely just like magically automate all the things. You know, if nobody touches any of the websites, basically nothing's going to cost you any money. If it gets a lot of traffic, then suddenly it's going to get expensive kind of thing, blah, 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 blah. Like, and it was like a COVID response for a large company, large organization, project. And to be fair, like the costs and everything on it were pretty good. Like the tech was, not gonna lie, pretty awesome. The code was legendary. It was architected by this great guy. And then came straight out of that into Cosmos and was just like, yeah, I guess if we just run this on AWS, right? How bad could it be? And it was just like over-engineered absolutely everything, overspent on absolutely everything for too long. And, you know, like I always just tell the story now of like for all of the monitoring and automated monitoring and backup monitoring and stuff that we used to run in that setup, like had this moment of clarity when I can't remember which network it was now. I think it might have been maybe when Mars, no, it wasn't. No, it was the second Juno cyber attack. Our monitoring stack got like, you know, responses that it couldn't really understand. And the monitoring just like fell below, you know, some threshold monitoring and just went, don't really know what's happening. Notify, and like didn't even come through for page duty because I was asleep and I had like, or whatever. And I just like, notify me that something a bit weird's happened. Fuck off. Meanwhile, I had like this little bit of code that called an AWS Lambda. I don't think it's ever actually cost us any money because it's never breached the whatever it is, million executions you need to actually pay any money for it. And it just says, hey, I'm alive. Hey, this, we used to have this on our Cosmos nodes. I was just like one morning I wrote it in like 5 minutes because I was paranoid about Cosmos nodes being down, and just goes, hey, I'm alive. Hey, I'm alive. Hey, I'm alive. And if it doesn't say, hey, I'm alive for like 3 minutes in a row, it just called my phone. And we have a slightly more complicated version of this now, but it just calls the ops shared phone number, which is like gets routed to everybody. And that fucking caught it. That stupid piece of code. It's like a bash script at the time. It was like bash script running in a CRUD job.
Hey, caught the there's cyber nothing attack. Wrong with that.
You put all nothing. The other shit, all the over-engineered stuff we had. We had like, what was it called? The AWS ops work observability thing on the boxes and everything. And of course, like, they were like, yeah, the RAM looks okay. I don't know what the fucking problem is. Like, yeah, the RAM looks okay because there's no transactions going through that server. Like, oh, man. So, yeah, that's a very long, rambling story to say. Over-engineering shit. I feel that deeply. I feel that deeply.
Did you run, like, or do you run, there's, like, that really complicated diagram out there for Cosmos with, like, the three sentry nodes and like three Horcrux signers and then like a private subnet and like all this shit. because the engineers at Flipside were actually asking me about that chart. And I was like, no, man, I'm a small node operator. Like, I can't afford, I can't afford 3 Sentry nodes, a validator node, and 3 Horcrux nodes for every single network I'm running. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So first of all, no, I don't. Second of all, I think that Strangelove, the makers of Horcrux, have the most interesting setup for their Horcrux. They keep their Horcrux nodes on the node of the signer, and then they only have one signer look at one node. So it basically gets rid of the one downside of Horcrux, which is latency. And they just like pound their own node. It's absolutely insane. And the way they do explain it to me, and the way like Kubernetes interacts with it. That's off topic, but it's interesting. And
yeah.
Some wild guys.
Their setup is pretty cool. We used to run Sentries for all the Cosmos networks we did. Yeah. That's why ultimately we didn't make much money.
Right. Yeah, we were doing it in the beginning, and then we were like, this is not sustainable. We're probably losing money at this point.
Yeah, I think that's basically why we lost money on Stargaze, despite being there from the start, having good delegations, is because we, for the first like maybe 9 months of the network, we were running... We were running a full Sentry architecture on AWS. And AWS, like, you know, I think we were running... For the Sentries, like we were running smaller boxes, but like we're still running an R5 XL. Or maybe.
Oh my God. You went hard.
Yeah, well, because the Cosmwasm chokes. Like you need that. It's RAM bottlenecked. You just need like 32 or 64. Or somebody can do the RAM bottleneck attack. Do you remember, like, were you on the early Juno testnets? Mm-hmm. Do you remember the one where me and Juno Swap Ben took down the network while we were drinking one night, and then told all the validators what we'd done afterward? We just like sent a message around saying, hey guys, we had a thought. We tried the thought. We did the thing. Sorry, we need to restart. We need to re-genesis.
I vaguely remember. That was like going from testnet, what was it, 2 to 3 or 3 to 4?
Maybe 1 to 2, actually.
Was it?
Very early. Yeah, it was like...
Okay. I do vaguely remember.
I think it might have been just post Juno launch, but like literally like 3 or 4 days post launch, something like that.
Yeah.
On the testnet. But that attack is what happened. If you're one of the nodes that's RAM was too low, at least in that first period of time when Cosmwasm was out in the wild, it was very, very easy for a developer to work out a way of triggering that attack, that particular attack. And that's why a lot of the networks at the time, we shared what we had done with other Cosmwasm networks. And that's why a lot of networks at the time sort of said, oh, actually, it's not immediately, like, it's not really an attack per se, because the transaction is valid and it can get through. But if enough of your consensus set doesn't have the RAM, they're going to choke, then the block will stall, and it's actually quite difficult and costly to get that back online. And what we of course found was that when it chokes, some people start messing with their nodes and their double sign, and the whole thing goes to fuck really quickly. Mm-hmm. Because they're down, and they're like, why am I down? It's like, well, you're down because your node's choked, but if you mess with it, it's definitely going to be down. good times.
Welcome to the party, Noel.
Hey, yeah, I'm like mid-transit driving back home to Brisbane from another place, so I stopped at the pub.
What does that sign say?
That's Tui's. Tui's new. Yeah,
top, Tui's. Top. All right, I'm going to see if I can find it.
And this is, if you're around, this is the top pub in Urella. But yeah, it's cold as fuck here. Not as cold as like that other place where I pulled up outside of a cafe once, but it's still pretty cold.
Was that the one in America where you turned off the podcast?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Hey, Brendan.
What's going on, Noel? Wait, so you're not in Australia?
Yeah. I'm in Australia. Yeah, I'm just.
Oh man.
I'm in transit driving.
I always picture Australia as being blazing hot. I didn't know it gets cold there.
Oh fuck.
Or upside down. It's always surprising when he actually writes it out.
Yeah, does the water rotate the opposite way when you flush the toilet, kind of thing?
The opposite to the northern hemisphere, yeah.
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 Wait, it actually does?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No, I just assumed it was a joke.
I thought it was a joke too.
It actually does. Physics.
Huh, okay.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, gravity. Rama, Americans are stupid, man.
I didn't deserve that.
I see you've played Knifey Spoony before.
So in the summertime it's hot, and in the wintertime it's cold, if you can imagine. So it's not like, you know, Northern America winter cold, but it gets to zero and that's enough to freeze my balls off.
Yeah, cold enough.
Yeah, I mean, I am wearing shorts right now and it's, I think, maybe 8 degrees, which is really shrinking my balls. But yeah, what's been happening? I'm a little bit late because there was roadworks. So what have we been talking about?
My data center. Talked about
The lab,
Puerto Rico.
Schultzy and I have been like talking about the lab in the side chat. And is it product complete now? Did you get your second internet? Your good internet? Your goodera?
No. So funny thing. Yesterday, the network engineer actually came out for laying the next line, and I'm in a flag lot, and so like I'm basically like, there's a moat of houses around me, and I'm looking. I can see out my window and see down the street where he's looking at the power line, and he's looking at it all confused. And I was like, oh, I should go see what he's doing. And I walk over there, and he's like, this isn't going to happen. I'm like, well, what's the problem? Like, the fiber's already ran. Why is this an issue? And he goes, do you see that port up there? We can't fill that port. We can't fill the port. Like, I've been talking to you guys for months. Like, why is this an issue? So I have to get DSL as the backup internet rather than fiber.
Ooh, that is not ideal.
Yeah. I guess the engineers are they have to do like a cost analysis on it, whether it's worth it. And me being a peon, it won't be worth it.
So over here, if the fiber doesn't run out the front of your house, you have to get it filled, but they just charge you. They're just like, it'll cost you 10 grand. And so you just
pay the money. I've got fiber. I've got 5 gig internet right now. It's just, I wanted the backup, and the backup would have been 500 meg.
Oh, so you got your business internet?
I have my business internet. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was trying to get another backup. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
so I'm not that concerned. I'm a little annoyed, but
Better than a kick in the nuts, I suppose.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, it is a kick in the nuts, but it's better than a legit kick in the nuts.
Yep.
So have you are you running anything in there at the moment that's like noteworthy, or it's just testing stuff? Sorry about the background noise, though. I'm like on the side of the highway.
Right. I can hear that. Have you got a beer or you got a coffee?
I have a coffee, but I did just notice a dude like walk behind me and hit that door real quick and then fuck off again. So it's 8:30 in the morning. But the Gentile looked reasonably disheveled, so I am certain he was after a beer.
I do have some prod stuff going right now, but not a whole lot just yet. Ethereum nodes are actively getting migrated now. Archives are almost entirely migrated. Really low priority master servers have been migrated over, or like actual validators have been migrated over.
You said your Ethereum stuff you're moving over. So are you like having backup nodes elsewhere for that?
Yeah. So we have, I think we're running 7 Ethereum nodes. So basically we're decommissioning like the offsite server ones that are in the US and just migrate them here. So most of the time, if we have US servers, they're on the East Coast. So add in 50 milliseconds of latency, which I'm willing to squirrel away by saying, hey, we self-host it in our data center, boys.
Is there why 7? Are they all mainnet?
Sorry, what was the question?
You said you have 7 Ethereum nodes. Are they all mainnet? Why 7?
So a lot of it is like basically where they are in the world. So we have 3 regions, right? So and then 2 in each region. And then 1 testnet, 2 testnets, 2 testnets, so 8 nodes.
Right. Is it? But like, are these for validators or are these for RPCs?
No. That's RPCs. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's a lot for a validator.
Yeah. No. That'd be way overkill.
Well, I'm told that they don't necessarily work very well when you've got them load balanced either. So because I think like the validator node subscribes to a RPC. So anyway, that's like we've got multiple, but they're sort of in like active backup for like, you know, SSV and OBOL and whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But to be honest, like Ethereum's so stable, I don't think it's ever fallen over on me. So the only thing you would really have is a hardware issue, I guess, or run out of space, but it doesn't even use that much space.
Is it pretty lightweight to note to run? I was in Dubai at the token conference, and in the Solana community, they like to talk shit on the Ethereum community and, you know, say the priority is allowing, you know, decentralization so you can run nodes on toasters.
Mate, you could run Ethereum on a fucking potato if you shoved an SSD in it.
Yeah,
100%. Like in the computer science department, I found that there was an academic blockchain project that a bunch of universities were running. It was a fork of Geith, and I literally just got forwarded an email being like, "Hey, this thing is down," and it was from like the maintainers at some European university saying, "Hey, your university's node is down." And it was one of those where then this got forwarded on from like the head of the department to somebody else, eventually washed up on my desk because somebody went, "Hey, he's a blockchain guy. He'll know how to figure this out." And I basically, end up finding I want to say it was an Ubuntu 18.3 LTS, something like that. It was a fucking old server, completely out. Like it was like EOL LTS server with just this stupid ass node on it. And the only reason it had crashed on this absolute potato, and it was like whatever server under the desk in like the IT service help desk room that they've been prepared to give these academics to just casually run a blockchain. They're probably like, yeah, sure. We're not even going to put that in our firewall. We're going to use Jenny, the little server that could under that desk there that's covered in coffee stains. And the only reason it stopped working was because the disk was full. And I was just like, oh, yeah, it's full, the disk full. And they're like, oh, right. how do we fix it? I was like, I literally, this server is fucked. We need a new server with a slightly bigger disk, but it will just work. And somebody plugged in another hard drive and just it continued fucking working. And I was like, love a fix where I don't have to do anything. Amazing. But Ethereum, man, like it would just run on anything. And it's like a Cosmos chain without Cosmosm. You're just like Cosmos chain without Cosmosm. You're just like, it's going to keep running. Who cares?
It does use a lot of space though. I think ours are 2 terabytes, maybe.
Yeah, that's probably about right. Like even this academic blockchain that was like empty blocks, it was still like, I think it had blown up at night, it busted through. Like, I think it was a 1 terabyte drive. And I mean, but then, you know, the flip side is like Solana guys like shitting on Ethereum. You're like, well, your blockchain is hugely resource intensive, still crashes a fair bit. And, you know, yeah, whatever.
Requires the dark web in order to work correctly.
Or like they also run like 30% of their traffic through like one provider or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which provider is that at the moment?
I can't remember the name, but
isn't it that one that was like recently purchased? Do you mean like one like hardware provider or one node provider?
Like one node provider, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I think it's those dudes that we were talking about last month that got bought for like some stupid amount of money.
Sounds about right.
Hmm. Yeah.
And then they like all their traffic goes through Jito too. So if basically Jito goes down, like no transactions will hit the chain.
Decentralization, baby. This shit works. I won't hear a word against this decentralization. Fuck. Anyway.
Circling back around to Cosmosm. You know, I feel kind of heartbroken that Cosmosm is basically going away. I think the death knell has been rung.
Yeah, but it's on the hub.
It is on the hub. That doesn't really mean anything. It's on the hub, but nothing's being built on it that I'm aware of.
Wasn't the hub going permissionless? I mean, this was literally, we had this, we had mags on the Poddo, you know, and there were rumblings about things to come on the Cosmos hub using Cosmosm, potentially permissionless Cosmosm. Although I guess we'll believe when we see it, right?
So the SIP 3 for say, I don't know if he's talked about this already, is just dropping entirely Cosmosm in the presumably in their new development Giga.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that, but yeah, I mean that's kind of that's the thing, right? Like, so many chains are just not opting to use Cosmosm anymore, and I don't know if it's for good reason or not. I mean, considering Confio, the maintainers and creators of Cosmosm have been defunded, it probably is for good reason, right? Like, why would you trust something that's no longer maintained?
Yeah, I think that's basically it, isn't it? At its heart, it's like the money's run out, and that's that. It's just like the rough economics of the space. But it is disappointing as somebody who invests quite a lot of time and effort in Cosmosm and its adoption, training developers, writing documentation, making videos, building protocols. Like, it is a much better product than the EVM. The EVM feels like boomer shit compared to Cosmosm. Like, it really, really does. Cosmosm is just a better tool chain. But to get to the level of developer tooling where it would really win people over, it just needed a lot more money and a lot more investment and a lot more adoption. And you know what? It's in microcosm. It's the same fucking problem as the whole of the Cosmos, right? You can sit on a really great app stack and it doesn't matter a shit. Like, it reminds me of the most extreme version of this is like the Move VM discussion, because I know we've been talking recently about so there's some stuff happening in Aptos at the moment, which is all about there's been a proposal to reduce the inflation rate on that network, and there's been some vigorous discussion on whether or not that is a good idea. But underneath all of it, there's this question of, like, you know, product market fit. And, you know, if there's demand for your tokens, a lot of the other problems resolve themselves. And if you have use cases, there's demand for your tokens, right? And you can have the most excellent smart contract framework and tooling for developers that are picky, right? And are prepared to stand a bit of pain to have a problem they have solved, if that's safety in the case of Move, or if it's just a comprehensible developer experience in Rust in the case of Cosmosm. But like, that doesn't attract users. Users don't give a shit how it's written. They just give a shit that it's good or it does something for them, right?
I mean, it doesn't even give a shit that it's good, right? Because it's arguably the reason why so many exploits exist on Ethereum.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously cybersecurity is a pretty tricky and complex subject, doubly so, you know, on blockchains, and triply so on, like, smart contracts. So, like, you know, I'm not gonna sit here and be like, oh, well, if you Cosmosm your things, there's no chance of getting owned. It's like, well, that's obviously fucking bullshit. But, you know, there's like, it's like the functional programming argument, right? If you have careful controls over mutable state, you're not going to have any programming bugs that involve mutable state. That's like the whole point of functional programming. And that's, you can kind of extend that argument to smart contract frameworks that have better guarantees about safety. It's like, well, okay, you're still going to get wrecked if you're going to get wrecked, but there's a certain class of bugs that you're no longer going to have. And as a developer, you can take that off your pile of shit to think about. And that's important if we're talking about programmable money, I think. It's just that it's not, do you know what, friend of I can't remember who it was, but somebody said a while ago, like, about decentralization, some friend of the podcast, that everybody says it's important, but nobody will fucking pay for it. I'll tell you that for nothing. And I can't remember who said that. Sorry, it's kind of lodged in my brain. But I think it's a little bit the same with, like, smart contract tooling and stuff, like, or application stack tooling. It's like exactly the same problem. I don't know how we get past it to not just building everything on the EVM like boomers, like ETH boomers, and we move on to, like, okay, can we find a use case that doesn't involve every single part of our application architecture just being whatever the answer to the question, just being whatever Ethereum does? That would be a good day. that when we move past that, I think. That was a bit of a rant. Sorry. I'll shut up now.
Do you think it's all related to developer tooling, or is some of it just people are after the liquidity, you know?
I mean, I think honestly, Brendan, you probably know better than I would about that, but I think you're right. Liquidity is obviously a big thing. I mean, liquidity is a huge thing when you look at versus the Cosmos, right? But I think it's also like maybe like also the brand and mind share. It's like, why is it easier to start a company in the Bay Area than it is to start a company in, you know, even in London, right? Biggest city in the UK, tech hub, ostensibly, much easier to start a company in probably SF isn't a fair comparison, but probably most US cities with a tech presence, it would be easier to start a company and get funding than it would be in London for a lot of use cases. And it's that, yeah, it's like that network effect, isn't it? I think that you have on Ethereum as well as just the, like you say, the pure liquidity, right?
I wonder how much of it also has to do with the, for lack of a better term, forkability. It seems like EVM lends itself really well to people just forking each other's projects and then launching their own based off of said fork. You saw that a lot with like Phantom. Phantom had a lot of copycats for their swaps.
At the smart contract level, you mean?
Smart contract and really the entire level. Smart contract level as well as...
You see a lot of ETH and I guess that's true. But I mean, to be honest, when you were saying that, I also thought, was just thinking, well, we're seeing a lot of networks where they just take the execution client or whatever from Ethereum. And it feels like there's enough developer mindshare throughout the Ethereum stack that people are remixing it, like kind of ad infinitum, whether it's smart contracts or bits of the execution client or the consensus client or whatever. And that's cool, but they're very incremental changes, I think, is the problem. And there's a lot of, but it's just VHS Betamax, isn't it? Again, so I don't know why I'm surprised. It's a tough one to solve. Like, and because I think the fundamental problem, I guess the root of my concern, I guess, you know, I don't know what you guys think about this, is that I still don't think, despite that point where they've got to where the remixing is happening, right? And remixing in the kind of sense of like taking an idea and making minor modifications to it, creating a culture around it and a discourse around it. I mean, that is not only the essence of culture, but it's also the essence of innovation, right? Which is cool. So it's good for Ethereum. It's good for the wider ecosystem that remix culture is happening. But what I don't see is any like Ethereum birthed NFTs. Cool. What other use cases, like real use cases, has it birthed since? You know, they did as NFTs, they did DEXs, they did a lot of those first things, and then I'm kind of waiting for another wow moment, and I'm not seeing it coming from that ecosystem. So,
big mistake. They did soulbound NFTs. You see, there you go. That's the big thing.
It's AI, man. It's all AI.
It's all AI. I mean, I said on the last podcast, I said like it is entirely possible that AI is the use case, and I'm wrong, and it's fine. And Null's gone. He's like, AI, I'm out.
No, this conversation, deuces. Yeah.
He's like, I want to go look at some hard drives.
Oh, he's back.
Yes.
All right.
I missed it. All right.
Okay.
See you, Null.
Peace out, buddy. Thanks, Null. I mean, what do you think of the, like, what kind of use cases are exciting you, Brendan? I know at the moment you've taken a little bit of a step away, I suppose, from... You're still running Whisper, right? So you have kind of, but you're not, my understanding is you're not like doing lots of active business development to like bring on new networks for Whisper at the moment, right?
Yeah, pretty much zero. So just running the existing ones I had, even kind of concentrating on a select few at this point. But yeah, mental bandwidth is kind of more on the broader ecosystem, trying to catch back up on what's going on out there. I feel like with running the validator stuff and running the day-to-day business, you kind of like lose track of where the market is going, where the space is going to a degree.
Yeah, so 100%. I don't know what your setup's like, but like I feel like maybe this has got better recently, but like especially maybe again early days, like do you remember in like 2021 when none of us even knew how many tokens we got and we were all trying to like write scripts to work out what our commission rate was so that we could like not get sent to jail for like misreporting taxes, like and it's just like you look up like 6 months later and you're like, I don't know any launches that have happened, I wonder why, right?
Yep. 100%.
But like what are the kind of things you're looking at now where you're looking at and you say, hey, that's pretty exciting, because I mean like you say you've got a little bit more perspective now maybe, and like even if it's like quite a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean I'm only like 2 weeks in, so not that much of a perspective, but
really you're only 2 weeks in. It feels like you've been migrated. Kid, my time frames are just so messed up.
It's Web3 in general, man. It's like a day feels like a year, you know? Yeah. I think some of the AI stuff is interesting. They're slapping it everywhere, but there was a project out there where the founder was ex-Uber, and they were building like payment rails for AI agents. I think that could potentially be an interesting use case where the blockchain's kind of confirming the actions the agents are taking and then taking payments, whether it be agent to agent or agent to external API. Because like, you know, who's going to run the payment system for all these AI agents out there?
Yeah. Well, I guess it'd be extremely profitable for anybody that did want to, but it would involve a fair bit of risk. I guess the real question would be like, who needs to audit it and when and by whom? Because the easiest solution is just make it public. And then the next thing you know, your AI agent has made a really, really identifiable set of transactions on your behalf, and somebody is coming to your house with a hammer.
Yeah. Well, there's a big push too to run a lot of the stuff in TEEs, Schulte. So like going back to the secret network days again, coming full circle, there, TEEs are a hot subject again because of all this AI crap. And I know Near Protocol, they were in a bunch of panels, and their product lead just kept hammering away at TEEs, and all these AI agents need to be running in TEEs.
I've said it many times in this podcast, but Near, I think, is one, it's my favorite blockchain. Like I think that their vision has been the most pure. If you've seen their white paper, or not the white papers, their whiteboarding series on YouTube. They basically interview all the different founders of different chains, and they talk about like what were the design constraints. And then they basically used all of those whiteboarding sessions with those founders to develop Near. And the things they've done in Near, it should be bigger than it is. Yeah. All I'll say.
I mean, maybe they're going to have kind of a renaissance. It seems like they have a lot of presence at conferences. They were everywhere at Token in Dubai.
Oh really?
And they're actually a big client of Flipsides as well. We just released our own AI insights product with Near. So
neat.
I'm curious to see what they'll do with it.
I think they've got a few dollary dues squirreled away, haven't they? Near Protocol. So there's definitely some like and I guess like Tendermint or the Hub is maybe a little bit of an example of this. There are definitely some crypto foundations that made so much money in their early ICOs or via VCs or just as the result of their tokenomics that they're basically too big to fail at this point, even if they don't execute their product vision. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic moving forward, right? As well, because I mean, there's kind of a little bit of that where it's just like even if they don't find a use case, they're just going to have a big treasury, which somebody will buy.
There's still ICOs out there like that. Like,
yeah.
I just saw someone that worked for Salt Lending the other day. I didn't even know Salt Lending was still around.
Interesting. I didn't know either.
I mean, yeah, you see a lot of stuff, like, especially because like academic papers take like so many years to get published that sometimes like I'll see a paper and read it and then be like, I'll have to go and double check like when it was first started versus when it was published, because I'll be like, is that protocol still alive? Or is it just that they took a data point in 2017 and then it's taken 5 years to get in this top journal because it takes a long time to write, like, you know, these really like top tier stuff? Or like, is it because that thing is still fucking going and it's because they're still going, they've got loads of money and they're trying to get academics to write papers about them, or they'll go, hey, you guys want data on decentralization or something? We'll give you archive access for free for no worries. And we'll give you developers to help you find the data if you're not very good at coding or whatever it might be. And you're like, ah, oh, that's what happened. it takes a bit of scratching, but you know, just forever looking for a use case, whatever it might be.